Chapter 21. Anarind. Mara rose well before dawn, or as she recently thought of it, rolled out of bed, because she often felt like a ball when she moved. She slept only 3 to 4 hours at a time, before discomfort and the need to urinate precluded sleep. She tried not to wake Yosef unless she needed help. That day he woke about dawn, they ate together, and he scurried off to the shops to check on various projects. Previously, Mara had accompanied him on his tasks, until her mobility kept her nearer to the house, and available beds, rockers, swings, cushions, anything to get off her feet before they swelled. Intellectually, she knew the side effects of pregnancy: swollen feet, frequent urination, and choppy sleeping. However, knowing and experiencing weren't the same. As one saving grace, she had suffered little of the expected morning sickness that women had warned her of. For her mother, it had lasted almost the entire length of her pregnancies and had run in her mother's family. Mara had assumed she would endure the same. Thankfully, it hadn't happened. Despite the aforementioned symptoms, she felt better than at any time in her life, a continuation of her good health since marrying. She had been a chronic sufferer of minor illnesses, what Yosef called colds, as long as she could remember. For whatever reason, she had had none since their marriage. Her sister Sinwin, when not pouting about something or another, usually pestered Mara for whatever new medicine Mara took, because Sinwin suffered from the same predilection for colds. Mara insisted there was no new medicine to explain her good health. Her mother attributed it to her being happy. Whatever it was, Mara felt good. The swollen feet, the frequent urination, and the spotty sleep were relegated to being mere irritants. Mara got a cup of kava from the kitchen and had just ensconced herself on a cushioned swing Yosef had built on the front porch of the house when Esiel Havant from the Kernford semaphore station rode up to the house, jumped off the horse as only a younger man could, and hurried up to Mara.
"How are you, Esiel?"
asked Mara of the man who usually delivered semaphore messages.
"I'm fine, Senkolsko Keelan. A beautiful day, and you're looking radiant. Being with child obviously suits you. I have a message for you from the station at the Keelan-Moreland border."
He pulled the message sheet from his pouch and held it out to her. She felt curious why in God's name she would get a message from there, and who could it be from?
"Thank you. Please wait in case I need to reply."
Esiel bowed slightly and went back to his horse. Mara unfolded the paper and read, "From Semaphore Station, Keelan-Moreland Border Post, to Mara Kolsko Keelan, Kernford. 22 Moreland women walked to the border post. Leader claims to know Mara Keelan and begs asylum. Holding women waiting instructions. Leader name, Anarind Moreland."
"Anarind?"
Mara gasped in shock. Since Anarind had disappeared during the raid into Moreland 4 months previously, there had been no word of her. Mara had felt conflicted. First, she hoped that Anarind was simply unaccounted for and would reappear. Then, when hope faded, Mara wondered whether Anna was dead or a captive of the Narthani. Given Anna's striking looks and the Narthani history, Mara shuddered to think what her life would be like as a Narthani slave. But Anna walking to Keelan? Why? Who were these other women? Where had she been? Why no word earlier? Questions, questions, too many questions. The answers lay with Anna herself. Ordinarily, Mara would have been tempted to jump on a horse or into a carriage and ride the 70 miles to the border, but not in her current condition. "Esiel," she called out to the messenger.
"I'll give you a message to send back to the border post. Wait here while I write it."
She went inside, sat at a table, and wrote, "To Semaphore Station, Keelan-Moreland Post, from Mara Kolsko Keelan, Kernford. Urgent you provide transportation of women to Kernford. Commandeer wagons and horses as necessary.
Expect to see them here within 2 days.
She gave her scrawled message to Havant, with stern instructions to get the message off immediately. She felt appeased that he nodded nervously. No one wanted to get on Mera Kolskokilin's bad side. He could not have gotten on his horse any faster, and he disappeared in a cloud of dust down the road back toward the semaphore station. That was an advantage to being the headman's daughter. People didn't want to irritate her. Mera sat back on the porch swing.
Anna. Oh, Anna, what have you been through and what's going on?
She sat there until Yosef came back for the midday meal. He could see she appeared pale, yet more excited than ill.
Mera, are you all right?
He asked. She nodded, and one corner of her mouth rose in not quite a smile, but more in reassurance.
I'm fine, Yosef. It's just that a semaphore message to me arrived this morning. From Anna.
Honorand, your friend. She's been found?
I know how hard it was for you to hear of her disappearance during the Iwalese raid. Did the message have word about her?
Yes, but it's very strange.
The Keelan-Moreland border post writes that Anna and some other women walked up to the post.
Walked? Nothing else?
Nothing.
Of course, semaphore messages are brief.
Still, I thought about asking for more information, but simply ordered the station people to provide transportation directly here as quickly as possible, and that I expected them to be here in 2 days.
Yosef smiled to himself. Mera had had no formal position, except that she was the daughter of Hetman Keelan. She rarely invoked that status, but when she did, she left little doubt she expected results.
How many women?
The message said 21, in addition to Honorand.
21?
Mera merely nodded.
Walking? Not wagons, horses? Walking?
Walking,
confirmed Mera with a worried look.
That doesn't sound good, said Yosef.
Why in the world would they be walking? Maybe their transportation left them near the station for some reason, instead of bringing them all the way into Keelan. Mera considered for a moment, then replied slowly, as if it were possible but unlikely.
Yes, I suppose that would be an explanation. Of course, then the question is, why leave them?
Well, we'll see when they get here.
Yosef thought for a moment.
This doesn't sound right.
You say they're supposed to be brought straight here?
Yes.
That means they will come by the main road from Moreland. Do they have food? Will whoever is bringing them here stay at villages or what? Mera looked at him blankly for a few seconds, then flushed angrily and let out a stream of Cadelli invectives that would not have been out of place in any pub. Yosef gave her another minute or so, then said reassuringly,
I'll go to the semaphore station and direct that provisions be provided en route. I'll pay any costs. I also think someone should meet them, just in case.
Just in case what?
Mera's eyes narrowed in a worried expression.
Just in case someone needs to meet them, said Yosef.
I'll ask Carnigan to go with me.
Not just Carnigan. Take Dennis and a few more men.
I don't think that's necessary, especially Dennis. He's so busy right now with other matters.
I do.
You're getting better on horseback, but humor me.
I'll feel better.
Yosef shrugged.
Dennis really is too busy for something like this. I'll be fine with Carnigan, and I'll take Balwis.
It took 2 hours to gather the party, and 3 hours before sunset they rode off by horse. Yosef was accompanied by Carnigan, a mendicant in training from the abbey, a disgruntled Balwis who had an assignation planned that evening with a widow in Kernford, and 7 other men, all armed. Yosef thought it overkill, but Mera had given in on Dennis and would not be thwarted for less than a 7-man escort. They covered 30 miles before total darkness descended, and it became dangerous for them and their mounts to keep up that pace.
They dry camped near a stream and were on the road again by first light, enough to see the roadbed clearly. Their obvious haste encouraged other travelers on the road to move aside. Yosef had wished he would never again have to make a long ride, but he felt encouraged that either his memory of the last time was faulty, or he had gotten better at this. It could also be the new horse Mara had given him. Yosef named him Mr. Ed, to everyone's bemusement. The horse was strong and fast, but easy to control, with a naturally smooth gait greatly appreciated by Yosef's butt. Seabiscuit had shown signs of getting along in horse years, and Yosef didn't want to stress the gentle gelding.
They alternately trotted, walked the horses, and took only occasional breaks throughout the morning and into the afternoon. Yosef got his usual odd looks when he began singing the Mr. Ed theme song. It was a loony moment, and Yosef laughed so hard he almost fell off Mr. Ed.
The 5-year-old Joseph Kolsko had watched the old TV series until disillusioned by an older sister that horses didn't actually talk. He still remembered the theme song lyrics. He sang in English, so none of the Cadelli had clues to the word's meaning.
"Are you going to tell us what's so amusing, or keep us wondering whether you've lost your mind?" Carnegie asked.
"How could you tell?"
asked Balwis, to the tittering of several escorts.
"It's a song for when you feel happy," said Yosef. "Like in a pub."
"What do the words mean?"
Carnegie asked.
"They don't translate well, so if you want to sing along, just try to copy the sounds."
"And let everyone who hears us think there's more than one idiot in this group?" snorted Balwis. "Think again."
Yosef broke into song once more, this time with Carnegie attempting to follow along. By the 10th iteration, 4 of the 7 escorts joined in.
"Oh, God," Yosef thought to himself,
"if I just had a camera and a microphone to record this for YouTube, it'd go viral within minutes."
10 armed men on horseback, 6 of them singing the Mr. Ed theme. On the second day, an hour before sunset, they saw 2 wagons heading south toward them. Within a few hundred yards, Yosef recognized them as the travel party. Balwis rode ahead, then Yosef got a close look at the wagon's contents when the rest of the men caught up with Balwis.
"Well, Jesus H. Christ!"
Yosef spoke angrily in English, so naturally no one understood. Each small farm wagon held 10 to 12 women, huddled together on the wooden bed, some of them gripping the side of the bed for support on one wagon. The other wagon had a simple flat platform, and the women had to be constantly alert not to be thrown off. They would be draggled, dirty, with ragged or torn clothing, some barefoot, and if Yosef's first glimpse of their feet was any indication, they must have walked much of the way from wherever they'd come from. Several showed bruises, fading, so however they'd acquired these, it had been at least some days ago. All had haunted eyes. Balwis was talking to one of the women when Yosef and the others arrived. The woman, a blonde, at least Yosef thought her hair blonde underneath the grime and dirt, seemed to speak for the group.
"Is this Honor in Moreland?" Yosef wondered.
He waited impatiently until Balwis finished speaking with her and came over to where Yosef stood, holding his horse's bridle.
"She says her name is Honorind Moreland and she wants to see Mara."
"Did she say anything about why they arrived to Keelan like this? Or who the other women are?"
"She wouldn't say. Just kept asking for Mara. One of the others mumbled something about escaping from the Iwilis."
"They look half-starved. Have they eaten today?"
Carnegie shook his head. "I doubt it. Maybe no water either."
"We'll go back to the village we just passed through," Yosef decided. "What was it called?"
"Dilston," said Balwis.
Yosef thought he noticed something in Balwis's expression.
What is it, Balwas?
The other man looked uncomfortable.
You know, I lived and worked in Moorland after I escaped Freddy. It just occurs to me that these women look like they have been cast out by their families. This sometimes happens if a Moorland family feels the woman has shamed the family honor. I heard in a pub that Stent Clansman rescued some women after the Moorland City battle. I'm wondering if these are some of them.
Why would they be cast out by their families after being rescued?
Yosef, Balwas said gruffly.
Think about it. These are all young women. What do you think the Nathanian Iwalis were doing with young women captives?
Yosef stared blankly for a few seconds at the women clutching one another, not looking at the Keelan men. He flushed angrily.
God damn it!
No translation was necessary.
He looked again at the women, this time looking differently at them. His eyes narrowed and focused.
Two of them looked as if they might be pregnant. Then a bundle that one woman held let out a weak cry, and he realized, shocked, that the bundle was a baby. At least one more woman held such a bundle. He looked straight into Carnegie's face and, with a cold voice they had not heard from Yosef before, asked,
They were thrown out by their families because they were raped against their will?
Carnegie looked uncomfortable.
Some families will feel they are dishonored. Not in all clans, of course, but I am afraid it does happen.
Clans are different. And the Moorlanders are among the pricklier in issues of honor. At least, as they think of it.
Assholes,
Yosef muttered, this time in Kudali.
Try to understand, Yosef. For the Moorlanders, after all they have been through, any association like this with the Nathani will be difficult for them to accept.
I can see that some of these women have a child or are with child. If what we suspect is true, these are children of their Nathania or Iwalese captors. It would be hard enough to accept the women back, but also the children of the hated enemy. It's just too much to expect of some families.
Yosef's face appeared no longer flushed, but instead was made of stone.
I keep forgetting, he thought to himself. I have to remember where I am. And even so, there were plenty of instances of similar attitudes back on Earth.
Recently, he had been thinking about the rumors that speculated about him being a Septarch. Usually, he studiously avoided saying anything to feed the rumors.
Not today.
If they insisted on assigning mythological status to him, he might as well use it. He raised his voice so all could hear and did his best prophet in the pulpit imitation.
It is against the word of God to punish those harmed against their will. He who cannot give understanding and mercy can expect none from God.
Carnegie looked taken aback by this sudden change in Yosef.
Balwas, jaded though he was, nodded and touched the amulet to guard the militant he wore around his neck. The leader of the wagons looked uncertain, but a little fearful at Yosef's tone. He obviously knew the rumors about this man. Yosef figured he might as well play the Septarch card for all it was worth. He tilted his head sideways and closed his eyes most of the way, as if listening to some faint voice. All of the others remained quiet. Even the women close enough to hear the exchanges kept silent, although in their case, due to confusion about what was happening. After a minute, Yosef opened his eyes and proclaimed in a loud voice,
I do not believe God is pleased by how these women were treated, either in their homeland or here in Keelan. I sense that he is close to being angry.
Yosef then changed his voice, so that he sounded like himself and not a prophet of God.
I think we need to get these women food, shelter, and let them clean themselves.
By now, the wagon master was pale and eager to appease whatever aspect of God he might have offended.
Yes, yes, he said. We need to get to the nearest village.
It took 20 minutes for them to arrive at the village of Dilston. Yosef did his best Old Testament prophet imitation stance while the initial discourse went on. The wagon master's explanation to the villagers occasioned surreptitious glances in Yosef's direction and a few clutches at amulets and hand motions to ward off any present evil spirits. Whatever the wagon master said to the village chief elicited an enthusiastic response from the villagers. Faster than Yosef would have predicted, a building, possibly a school, was cleared and bedding for the women laid out on the floor with cushioning under the bedding. The women of the village led groups of the women to different homes, to return later bathed and in some cases with new, if plain, clothing. Later, Yosef's party and the women were fed plentiful plain village food. Yosef didn't rush leaving the next morning, letting the women get as much sleep as they needed. The sun was well up when all felt ready to depart. Yosef thanked the villagers and told them he had a dream that God was pleased with them. An audible sigh ran through the 70 to 80 villagers who witnessed their departure. Yosef thought he might as well reinforce the lesson and gave the village chief enough gold coins to more than pay for all they had provided, along with an admonition to remember to practice God's mercy. Several of the moorland women cried as the wagons moved out of the village. It had been the first time in however long that people had been kind to them. As Yosef rode to the front of the party of wagons and his travel companion's guards, he got his first real look at the woman who had to be Honorend. The dirty, bedraggled hair was now clearly the golden blonde Mara had described, tied in a ponytail. He briefly glimpsed blue eyes in a haggard face. Because the road paralleled the semaphore line, Yosef sent Mara a message from the next station, saying they were on the way back with the women. He felt undecided about whether to go slow and stop again for two more nights or push on ahead harder. He finally thought it would be best to get the women to St. Tomo's Abbey in Kernford and the medicants as fast as possible. They stopped once more at another village and repeated the theatrics of the first night. The next day they rose at first light, pushed on to Kernford, and reached the abbey at midday. The medicants cared for the women and provided shelter. Honorend allowed herself to be checked briefly by the medicants and then insisted on traveling on to Mara. It was dark when Honorend and Yosef arrived home in a Keelan carriage sent by Mara and driven by Carnegie. Kerosene lanterns lit the front veranda where Mara waited. Not a sound came from either woman as Mara rose from a rocker and Honorend stood by the carriage after Yosef helped her down. Then, as if in slow motion, Mara came down the steps as Honorend walked forward. They met at the bottom of the steps. Then slowly, as if afraid to dissipate a dream, their arms encircled each other, and both women broke into deep sobs. Yosef thanked Carnegie, who handed the carriage off to a manor worker, and the big man walked back toward Kernford. Balwis watched for several minutes, then headed for the cottage he slept in when staying on the grounds. A good 10 minutes passed before the torrent of tears slowed, and Yosef guided the women into the house and the parlor, the two women clinging as if afraid of losing the other. Yosef went into the kitchen and brought back water, wine, and glasses. He set them on a table next to the women and retreated to his library and writing in his journals. It was almost 3 hours later when Mara came into his workroom, tear-streaked, happy, and angry all at once. "She's sleeping in the bedroom next to ours. I got several glasses of wine into her, and she finally relaxed enough to fall asleep. I expect she'll sleep until tomorrow, and then I'll see what I can do to care for her." "How is she?"
Yosef inquired softly.
She was a slave of the Narthani for 3 months, Mera snapped bitterly. How do you think she is?
He didn't know what else to say at that moment, so said nothing.
Mera slumped into a chair, closed her eyes, and laid her head on the chair back, silent for several minutes. Then,
I'm sorry, Yosef, she said. There's no reason to yell at you. None of this is your fault. And Anna told me how you took care of all the women. Thank you for that. It's just that. I'm so overjoyed that Anna is safe here. But at the same time, I want to scream to the heavens that this happened to her.
Yosef moved to Mera's chair, sat on the edge of the cushion, and pulled her to him. She didn't resist, letting her head rest on his chest and clutched him. After another quarter hour, Mera turned businesslike once again and insisted they find something to eat in the kitchen before retiring. The next morning, Yosef left to meet with Lewis and Kenrick while Mera waited for Anarin to waken. She waited until almost midday, checking several times an hour on Anarin. As soon as her friend woke, a hot bath awaited, followed by a clean robe and food and wine on a small table under a pergola behind the house. They spoke little until they finished eating. Finally, Anarin looked into her friend's eyes. Her right hand gripped Mera's left, and she recounted the previous months. Mera listened without comment, a flood of empathetic emotions coursing through her. She remained silent while Anarin recounted her escape and return home. For Anna, the decision to leave her family was easy and heartbreaking. The Stent clansmen had been observing the walls of Hounslow, the Iwalese capital. 1,200 Stent and Huon men had ridden hard to get to Parthmol, the Narthani staging base for the Moorland invasion, before the withdrawing Narthani force arrived back across the Iwa-Moorland border. After surprising and annihilating the 200-man supply base, a scouting party had pushed on to the outskirts of Hounslow. The Stent party of 50 men was about to leave the forest edge a mile from Hounslow when the ragged, bruised, and terrified trail of women staggered out of the darkness. Half of the women were hysterical with relief when they realized the horsemen were not Iwalese. The other half were too exhausted to talk. It was Anarind who identified them as slaves escaped from Hounslow. The 50 Stentees needed to return to the main force 10 miles away, but there was no question that they would take the women, even if it slowed them and risked an encounter with Iwalese or Narthani mounted patrols. 38 women and children rode double the 70 miles back to Moorland City, stopping only once to sleep on the ground after crossing the Moorland border. A few women were left at their home villages or farms on the way, but most rode all the way to Moorland City, where the Stentees turned them over to the Moorland Authority to repatriate to their families, if the families existed. Some women returned to find their immediate families dead or still missing from Iwal raids. These women were sent to their nearest relatives. Other women were Predi, whose families were lost or dead, had disappeared, or had been shipped off Cadellium to Narthon. Families took in these women, or abbeys cared for them, until permanent places could be found. All of these women were, in a way, the fortunate ones, because they knew their status, no matter how bad. Not so for many of the Moorland women with still living families. There, the receptions varied. Anna witnessed one woman embraced by parents, husband, and children, all crying with joy. Her own reception differed dramatically. Word was sent to her family, 40 miles from Moorland City, that they needed to come get her. A 6-day had passed before her oldest brother, Heilrond, came to claim her. They had never been on the best of terms, and his obvious disgust at seeing her foretold her reception at home. Her father never spoke to her, and she later learned he had ordered that she never be in his presence. Heilrond left her at a cottage on the edge of the family land and told her not to come to the house. The next day, her mother came to the cottage, and Anarin described what had happened to her. How she and Aunt Tilda, her mother's sister, had been taken captive in Lanwith when they had gone the 10 miles from the family estate to shop. Her aunt's thoughtful and fateful attempt to get Anarin away from her father's baleful presence for even a few hours. The last Anarin saw of her aunt was when they, along with all of the other captive Moorland women and children, were herded into a corral to be dispersed to masters, brothels, or slave markets. Anarind had been pulled out by an Arthani officer, Colonel Erdalin, she later learned, the overseer of Eywill province, and one of the highest-ranking Arthani officers. Her mother's eyes teared up at the news about her sister. But not when Anarind recounted her own fate as the concubine of the Arthani officer. Anarind admitted she had done what she had to in order to survive and not be sent to the brothels, but her mother slowly pulled away from her as more details came out. Anarind had no thought to hide anything. This was her mother. Only when she finished describing how she'd kept from becoming pregnant by taking the root extract given to her by another woman slave, Gwynedd, and how they had escaped, did Anarin notice her mother had moved away from her, with a face cold, eyes dry, and arms crossed in front of her. She heard no words of consolation or welcome home. "You're our child, and we can't send you away. But we don't need to see you more than necessary. And you're not to come to the house where others might see you and the rest of the family be shamed." Shamed? Anarind wanted to scream. For this happening to me beyond my control? Merciful God, you're my mother. Without another word, her mother spun and left the cottage. Anarind didn't see her mother again until almost a month later. Despite the rejection, her urge to glimpse any family member became too strong. And Anarind walked along a path that wound through a grove of trees 100 yards from the family home. She watched the house too closely and didn't hear approaching laughter until her mother and 2 brothers rounded a bend. The 4 of them stood staring, shocked or surprised for several seconds. For a moment, Anarind thought her mother would come to her. When an anguished expression washed over her mother's face, and Heilrond grabbed their mother's arm.
"You were told not to come near the house! Now get back to where you belong, before we forget our charity for letting you stay even there!"
It was the last time she saw any of them before deciding. This wasn't home anymore. Home was where you were wanted, where people cared for you and you them. She had no future here. Out of her distant relatives, none came to see her or intervened in her behalf with her parents. She returned to the empty cottage and yelled, "The hell with you all!" Where could she go? Only one possibility rose in her mind. Mara. She hadn't had writing materials to send a letter to Mara, and even if she had, no one would have taken it to the closest registrar office to get in a mail packet. Should she ask neighbors or anyone in the nearby village for ink and paper? She would have to walk to the registrar and had no coin to pay even the small fee. Gwynedd, another escaped slave, a Predi, the one who had sympathetically advised her on how to survive. Gwynedd, who had become a friend, a sliver of consolation in her months in Hounslow. Anarind had said goodbye to Gwynedd in Moorland City when distant relatives of Gwynedd's came for her. Anarin remembered that she lived in a nearby village, only a 15-minute walk from the city's outer wall. A village named something like Hallsworth or Halston or something close. Anarind would go to Mara, who certainly wouldn't turn her away, she hoped. Moorland City was on the way, and she would try to find Gwynedd, see how her friend was doing, and say goodbye. Maybe in Moreland City she could send Mera a letter. Anarind packed enough food for 3 days, almost all she had in the cottage, a wineskin of water and a change of clothes. She put on her only pair of shoes and started walking at dawn the next morning. 2 full days later, the tops of Moreland City's buildings came in view. It was too late to try to find Gwynedd that day, so she slept once more on the ground, covered by a cloak. The next morning she asked and found directions to the village of Hallstorm, the closest-sounding village to what she could remember Gwynedd telling her. After an hour's walk to the village of perhaps 300, she was told Gwynedd lived somewhere in Moreland City. Her distant family in the village had refused to let her stay, unless she got rid of the half-Narthani child she'd borne during her years as a Narthani concubine. Gwynedd had refused and left from Moreland City. Anarind retraced her route back into Moreland City. Even with more than 20,000 people in the city, news of the escaped women was widely known, and Anarind needed only an hour to find one of the other women. Not Gwynedd, but she knew where Gwynedd worked, at a seamstress shop. Their reunion was tearful and bitter. Anarind learned that her experience and Gwynedd's were not unique. While many of the women had been accepted gladly by their families, others suffered rejection or had no families to come back to because they were from Predi or even from elsewhere on Anyar and had been brought to Gedalion by the Narthani. Anarind stayed with Gwynedd in a corner of the seamstress shop, and in the next 6 days, the two of them tracked down all of the escapees living in or close to Moreland City. Anarind had already asked Gwynedd to come with her to Keelan, sure that Mera would help. When 7 others eventually asked if they could come too, and Anarind told them she couldn't ensure the reception, most of them asserted that things couldn't be worse in Keelan province. When it came time to leave, word had spread, and 22 women had showed up, with 2 toddlers and 2 babies still nursing. The women didn't have enough coin among the group to pay for transportation, so they started walking. They used what coin they had to buy food on the way and asked for charity when the coin was exhausted. A number of the women were weak from hunger or illness, and the children had to be carried. Some days they traveled only 5 miles. 3 times, farmers with empty wagons gave them lifts for a few miles, with all of them packed on top of one another and hanging off the wagon beds. On the 8th day, they reached the Keelan Semaphore station just across the border. There, Anarind asked, then begged, then threatened the station agent to send a message to Mera Kolsko-Keelan. "It costs 25 kron to send a semaphore message. Do you have it?" asked the agent, a disdainful curl to his lips. "No," said Anarind, "but Mera Kolsko-Keelan will pay it, and more. I'm a friend."
"You," said the agent. "Why would the headman's daughter and the wife of Josef Kolsko be a friend of yours? And a Morlander at that."
"Do you want to take that chance?" Anarind retorted. "If I'm telling the truth and you don't send it, you'll risk the anger of both Hetman Keelan and Josef Kolsko." The threat made the agent pause to reconsider. He looked at the station counter, bare for the moment of messages to be relayed in either direction. So should he risk that this bedraggled woman had told the truth? He thought for several moments, then decided, why not?
"All right," he said. "What's the message?"
Although Anarind wanted to slump to the ground in relief, she held herself firm. "Just say that Anarind Moreland is at the border and needs transportation for herself and 21 other women. The agent shook his head.
"I'll send it, but you should figure out what you're going to do if no return message comes, or it comes and Mera Kolsko-Keelan has never heard of you."
To the agent's shock and relief that he'd wisely sent the message, an answer came to arrange transportation to Kernford.
He provided water and enough food for a few bites for each woman and child, and two wagons from a nearby village left the station heading south. He didn't know what was going on and felt relieved to be rid of them. They slept in a barn that night, while the two drivers slept under the wagons. The next midday, a group of riders pushing their horses hard met them. All of the men were armed, and many of the women cowered in the wagon beds. One man rode ahead to the wagons, a hard-looking man with a facial scar. Of the other men, one was a huge, red-headed man with a ferocious countenance. All of the men seemed to defer to a third man, of average height, sturdily built, with brown hair and lighter, fine streaks. When he came near the wagons, Honorend could see that he had unusually light blue eyes, almost gray. It was well past mid-afternoon when Honorend got around to talking about herself.
I thought of killing myself. Oh, God. You don't know how many times I thought about it. I didn't, because I hoped for rescue or escape. Then, when hope faded, I knew the word forbids it. I wondered if I believed in God anymore. Then another thing stopped me. After what they had done and were doing to my people, and after what Erdalyn had done to me, if I killed myself, I would let them win. If I died, Erdalyn would only take another woman. So, to spare myself, I would condemn another victim to the same treatment. In the end, I couldn't do it.
Mara had sat listening as Honorend unburdened herself, her eyes vacillating between fury at what had been done to her friend, more than a sister, and pain at hearing what Honorend had endured. Though her eyes burned, she determined not to shed tears and to give Honorend the time and space to be supported. Honorend stopped talking and stared out the window. One of the thousand-yard stares Yosef had described to her, of men too long in battle.
When I accepted I wouldn't kill myself, I thought hard about what I would do.
Honorend continued softly.
I knew I couldn't simply accept being a slave to the Narthani. Erdalyn would either keep me or eventually pass me on to another Narthani, or even to the brothels, if I displeased him. But while I was alive, there were always options. I might have a chance to escape. If I failed and was killed, it wouldn't be suicide. Also, I could one day kill Erdalyn while he slept. Again, if they killed me for it, God would surely not see it as taking my own life.
Honorend stopped talking and for the first time had a warm look in her eyes.
The thing that helped the most was you, Mara. I told myself, what would Mara do? She would be brave. Therefore, I had to be brave no matter what happened. Brave like Mara. Many days,
Honorend swallowed hard,
and nights, I had to be brave, as I knew you would be.
Mara wanted nothing more than to tilt her head to the sky and scream,
brave? Me? Oh, merciful God, Anna. I don't know how I could have been as brave as you.
She didn't say those words. Now was not the time, if ever. For now, the only thing that mattered was Anna being alive and safe. And Mara would do whatever she could to help her.